It is Friday, May the 27th, and this is VOA's International Edition. Good to have you with us today. Coming up, just how big is that threat from the Islamic State? Israel's leaders seeking a coalition to govern.
In order to do it, there were two choices, to move toward a coalition with the more centrist Labor Party or to move to the right-wing Israel Home, Israel Bateinu Party.
Also ahead, Syria's humanitarian plight, world's health emergencies, plus choosing a new U.S. president. Hello, everyone. I'm Steve Norman. U.S. officials are warning of the Islamic State's ability to inspire violent deeds around the world, including in the United States, without commanding or having any direct contact with terrorists. U.S. Homeland Security Deputy Secretary Alejandro Mayorkas spoke before lawmakers who are examining the threat of the Islamic State militants.
The threats we face today are more complex and decentralized than they were a decade ago. We are in a new phase of the global terrorist threat. We have moved from a world of terrorist-directed attacks to a world that increasingly includes the threat of terrorist-inspired attacks, one in which the attacker may never have come face-to-face with a member of a terrorist organization, but has instead inspired it by the messages and propaganda of ISIL. By their nature, such inspired attacks are harder for intelligence and law enforcement to detect and could occur with little or no notice, presenting a more complex security challenge.
Some of the members of the U.S. Senate committee expressed concern the Islamic State's use of the internet and social media to attract followers. U.S. State Department Acting Coordinator of Counterterrorism Justin Sibarell spoke about the militants' use of the most up-to-date technology to get out their message and to recruit fighters.
ISIL's use of propaganda, the use of social media and the internet to propagate their message and to use the internet as a very effective tool to recruit new members really has been unprecedented, and it's not something that we've seen used as effectively by any other group previously. I think their message has been blunted. That narrative of victory they relied upon so successfully in their early period of recruitment, if you think in the 2014, early 2015 era, there's been significant losses that ISIL has suffered. That narrative of victory has been blunted somewhat. They're not delivering effectively on governance. And you noted the statistics on, they're focused on 52% of their messaging on quality of life. Well, they've suffered in their ability to provide that quality of life.
U.S. senators of both major political parties say they expect a long battle against violent extremism, including the violence perpetrated by the Islamic State and its supporters around the world. In other news, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has widened his grip on the parliament by signing a coalition agreement with the Yisrael Beitenu party, giving the defense portfolio to party leader Avigdor Lieberman. He's a controversial figure who once served as foreign minister. The elevation of Lieberman, a hardliner on the Palestinian issue, raised concern here in Washington. Mark Toner, a U.S. State Department spokesman, noted reports from Israel describing the government as the most right-wing coalition in Israeli history.
We also know that many of its ministers have said they oppose a two-state solution. This raises legitimate questions about the direction it may be headed in and what kind of policies it may adopt. But ultimately, we're going to judge this government based on its actions. We're going to work with this government as we have with every Israeli government that preceded it, with the goal of strengthening our cooperation. And we remain steadfast in our commitment to the security of Israel and then our commitment to working towards a two-state solution.
But Mr. Netanyahu, following the resignation of Defense Minister Moshe Yaalon, insisted his government is committed to the two-state solution.
My government remains committed to pursuing peace with the Palestinians, pursuing peace with all our neighbors. My policy has not changed. We'll continue to pursue every avenue for peace while ensuring the safety and security of our citizens. I believe the developments in the regions have created new challenges for us all, but I also believe that they've created new opportunities for peace, and I intend to seize those opportunities. A broader government, a more stable government, will make it easier to do so.
Lieberman, a firm commitment to peace and a final status agreement with the Palestinians. Meantime, Russell Stone, professor emeritus at American University's Center for Israel Studies, tells VOA's Victor Beatty, Mr. Netanyahu faced one-seat majority in parliament that proved to be unstable.
In order to do it, there were two choices, to move toward a coalition with the more centrist Labor Party or to move to the right-wing Israel Home, Israel Bateinu Party, led by Lieberman and supported largely by Russian recent immigrants to Israel. Lieberman lives in a settlement in the West Bank and as such is on principle not committed to a two-state solution, but to maintaining Israeli settlements in the Palestinian territories. So that part was of concern to the American government. On the other hand, there were statements from the Department of Defense that they look forward to working with him as defense minister. Now, previously, he'd held a cabinet post as foreign minister, and in that government, both the Americans and the Israeli leadership had kind of isolated him. He never got deeply involved in foreign relations with major allies. Instead, his beat was the former Soviet Union countries in Eastern Europe. Subsequently, Netanyahu took over the foreign ministry post himself, which he continues to hold. So he's both prime minister and foreign minister.
Why do you think Mr. Netanyahu went to the right rather than to the center to widen his coalition?
It was an expedient. He had to probably give up less going to the right than to the center. It may be more consistent with his, on the one hand, stating that he's committed to a two-state solution, but not really willing to go forward with it.
It's made some impression on the State Department about the legitimate questions that it raises about the commitment to the two-state solution. Are there?
Yes. If you take the official stand, no. He says he's committed to it and that there's no viable partner to work with on the Palestinian side. If you look at his actions and this recent political act, no, he's not.
And what do you think the direction of the Israeli government will be going forward?
Probably not too much different from what it already is.
Russell Stone also said the U.S.-Israel strategic relationship will remain strong. And among the stories we're staying on top of, the DRC security forces breaking up anti-Kabila protest. Diplomat is found dead in San Salvador. World Bank loaning prompts credibility questions. Plus an artist, an athlete, and a diplomatic fight over gender equality. We'll have expanded stories like that and more at voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. Many Syrian civilians will face starvation if government troops and armed rebels do not allow greater access to humanitarian convoys who are carrying life-saving supplies. Staffan de Mistura, the UN envoy for Syria, has been trying to keep talks about between the two groups alive so that peace can eventually come to end Syria's civil war and the resulting hard times for the people of Syria.
There is a sense of urgency in having the talks resumed, because we need to keep the momentum. But those talks, in order to be credible, based again on the Vienna decision, need to have a credible ground based on humanitarian improvement and on cessation of hostilities improvement and stabilization.
De Mistura's second-in-command and head of the Syrian Humanitarian Task Force, Jan Egelin, meanwhile, said it had so far this month proved far more difficult than it expected to reach people in besieged and hard-to-reach parts of Syria with aid.
Of the 1 million people that we have planned and have tried to reach by land in May, we've only so far reached 160,000. So we need to reach a lot of places in the remaining days of May and before the 1st of June for this to be anywhere near what we had hoped.
The United Nations says more than 400,000 people are living under siege in Syria, most of them in areas besieged by the regime, they say. Since February, there have been efforts to dramatically scale up the humanitarian aid access to those areas, but delivering supplies has become increasingly difficult amidst the surge in violence that has left a February truce hanging by a thread. This is VOA.
When news breaks, VOA News is there.
VOA.
Around the clock, listen to VOA newscasts on the top of each hour, along with our detailed news shows and analysis.
VOA News. We're online at voanews.com.
At voanews.com.
VOA, your trusted source of news and information.
Jazz America.
This is Russ Davis, and on my program Jazz America, I carry on the tradition begun decades ago by the great Willis Conover by exploring the wonders of a century of jazz history. I'll cover it all from Dixieland to swing to bebop to modal, free jazz, fusion, world jazz, contemporary, and beyond. Plus, you'll hear the words of the artists themselves as they tell their incredible stories. Join me for Jazz America, Saturdays and Sundays at 13 hours Universal Time, online at voanews.com and the Voice of America.
This is VOA's International Edition. Turkish financial markets were thrown into a turmoil this month when Prime Minister Yahmet Davutoğlu announced that he was stepping down. Kamban has been restored with the reappointment of a new government. Dorian Jones reporting now from Istanbul.
Financial markets recovered most of their losses since the reappointment of Turkey's Deputy Prime Minister Mehmet Şimşek. The reappointment of Şimşek, a former international banker, saw financial markets recover most of their losses they incurred after the ousting of Prime Minister Davutoğlu. Chief Economist İnan Demir of Istanbul-based Finans Bank says Şimşek's presence in the new government is seen as a positive gesture by President Recep Tayyip Erdogan to international markets.
With Mehmet Şimşek in the government, they at least think that the government is still trying to keep markets, at least to some extent, happy. But the bottom line is that Mehmet Şimşek is unlikely to have a significant room for maneuver.
Şimşek has lost his key role of supervising the country's financial markets, and there are concerns about the future of strict regulation and supervision of the markets introduced in cooperation with the World Bank and IMF following the country's financial crisis. Political consultant Attila Yeşilada of Global Source Partners says Erdogan's oversight of economic policy will add to the unease.
Erdogan is already putting his stamp on policies. The policy outlines are shaping up. Erdogan said his concerns regarding low interest rates ought to be treated with more seriousness, meaning that he wants faster rate cuts. I think we're going to see more mega projects. Essentially, Erdogan runs the country.
Analysts warn interest rate cuts could threaten the country's currency, with Turkey having to attract large amounts of foreign capital to finance its trade imbalance. Dorian Jones of VOA News, Istanbul.
World Health Assembly has approved reforms that will increase the UN Health Agency's ability to respond rapidly and more effectively to health emergencies. Lisa Schlein reporting now from Geneva, where a panel of experts discussed how new measures will help countries tackle emergencies such as Ebola, Zika, and yellow fever.
Piecemeal reforms of the emergency health system have been underway for years, but it was the unprecedented Ebola epidemic in West Africa that triggered a serious overhaul of the World Health Organization's method of response. While Ebola was declared in Guinea in March 2014, it took the WHO 5 months and many deaths before it pronounced Ebola an international public health emergency. Doctors Without Borders, or MSF, was an early and vocal critic of the agency's slow response to Ebola, a disease that killed more than 11,000 people by the time it was declared over in December. Joanne Liu, president of MSF, says the global fear Ebola generated resulted in a cascade of initiatives for reform.
The creation of the new WHO Health Emergencies Program is a positive step forward. But we know there is no quick fix. There is no cheap fix. So without the buying of member states and strong leadership, it will die on paper.
The World Health Organization reports 130 million people worldwide need humanitarian assistance, and all are in need of health assistance today. WHO Director General Margaret Chan says outbreaks such as Ebola, if not managed early, can get out of hand and become a humanitarian crisis. She says the WHO and its partners are working very hard to manage the Zika outbreak.
The Zika outbreak is now rampaging so many countries, and not just in the Americas region, but Zika is at the doorstep of Africa now, with movement of people around the world. And this is the kind of thing we should expect. We need to be prepared so that every country have the capability and capacity to prevent, to detect, and to respond to any emergencies.
Chan says emergencies have become the new normal. Brazil is the epicenter of the Zika outbreak. The country has confirmed thousands of cases of the Zika virus and hundreds of pregnant women with microcephaly linked to brain disorders in newborn babies. Brazilian Health Minister Fonseca Santos says his country has increased its surveillance system and undertaken a vigorous vector control program. He says it is investing $250 million in research.
The most important lesson was that we should be prepared all the time, even for disease that we are used to them, and we believe sometimes that we know everything about it, and it can still surprise us anytime and become an emergency.
Yellow fever has spread from Angola to the Democratic Republic of Congo, which has confirmed 41 imported cases. Bokenge Boswa of the DRC Ministry of Health says his government has drawn up a response plan which focuses on prevention and preparation. He says a vaccination campaign began Thursday in the capital, Kinshasa, and will last until June 6th. He speaks through an interpreter.
Also, we're focusing on mandatory vaccinations for travellers to Angola. Anyone who goes to Angola needs to be vaccinated against yellow fever.
While most of the experts dwelled upon the reforms in regard to emerging diseases, MSF President Joanne Liu reminded them that the threat to health was not limited to infectious diseases.
From Yemen to Syria, from Central African Republic to Niger, health facilities are looted, burned, and bombed. Patients are slaughtered in their beds. Health workers are abducted, assaulted, and killed.
A new WHO report on attacks on healthcare in emergencies finds more than 60% in the last 2 years were intentional. It says health facilities and health workers are deliberately targeted, and the attacks, which deprive thousands of people of essential care, are not stopping. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
In U.S. presidential politics, the Republican Party presumptive nominee Donald Trump says he has now secured the support of enough delegates to get the nomination. He spoke in the city of Bismarck, North Dakota.
The folks behind me got us right over the top from North Dakota, so North Dakota made a big statement, and I just really appreciate it. We will not forget it. Thank you very much.
Trump went on to take the opportunity to remind voters and the world, for that matter, what his international policy will be like.
When you rattle someone, that's good, because many of the world, as you know, many of the countries in our world, a beautiful world, have been absolutely abusing us and taking advantage of us. So if they're rattled in a friendly way, we're going to have great relationships with these countries. But if they're rattled in a friendly way, that's a good thing, John, not a bad thing.
During a speech at the Petroleum Conference that was going on in North Dakota, Trump attacked Democratic Party frontrunner Hillary Clinton's positions on energy policy, drawing some sharp contrast between the two on an issue that could be a factor in the general election. Clinton and her opponent for the presidential nomination of the Democratic Party, Bernie Sanders, continue to campaign. Most data indicating right now that Clinton already has enough support to secure the nomination, but Sanders vows to stay in the race until the end. Before we leave the subject of U.S. politics, we should note that there has been a lot of buzz in the last 24 hours about a potential debate between Trump and Sanders. Our social media expert, G. Abby Lee, has the latest. Hi, G.
Hello, Steve. Both of them want to debate each other. After Sanders agreed to the debate, hashtag #BernieTrumpDebate has been trending Thursday. Sanders posted on Twitter and Facebook, "Game on. I look forward to debating Donald Trump in California before the June 7th primary." Trump had told comedian Jimmy Kimmel that he would debate Sanders for charity.
Yeah, interesting choice. How are the people responding to that?
People are liking it. Sanders' tweet got more than 44,000 likes, and he also sent out this tweet Thursday afternoon. "I am delighted that Donald Trump has agreed to debate. Let's do it in the biggest stadium possible." Turning to reactions on Facebook, more than 140,000 people liked his post, including activist Sean King and hip-hop artist Mac Lethal. Some of the top comments are about how the American people deserve to see the difference between the two contenders and that it could be the biggest presidential debate in history.
Mm-hmm.
That's all for me, Steve.
Yeah, right. Yeah, thank you so much, G. That's our own social media guru, G. Abby Lee. By the way, you can follow G on Twitter at G. Abby Lee. I'm there as well at VOA Norman. And you can follow International Edition on Twitter at VOA_IE. This is VOA.
This is BizBeat.
Vinyl records produce sound the old-fashioned way, with a needle running on vinyl. But vinyl's turning the tables on CDs and iPods now, as there's a growing worldwide demand for records. Robert Maley is a DJ and record store owner. He says people are fed up with the virtual music. They want the same experience as their parents, to take a record from the cover and put it on a turntable. Demand so high for vinyl these days, a 65-year-old Czech company is opening a new factory in Canada to keep up with the market. Michael Sturba is the director general of GZ Media. He says, at the moment, we export an absolute majority of what we make, and a third of our production ends up in North America. It's estimated 100 million records were sold around the globe last year, and GZ's sales of vinyl have gone from nearly 14 million records in 2014 to what they expect will be 25 million this year. For VOA's BizBeat, I'm Philip Alexio.
This is VOA's International Edition. Good to have you with us today. You know, they are known for their pulse-pounding trance tracks, that's right, but the British-based trio Above and Beyond out touring now with a total acoustic setup. International Edition's David Byrd tells us the three DJs have traded in their turntables and headphones for harps, pianos, and guitars.
Most of the time when you attend an Above and Beyond show, you get something like this. That's what the trio, John O'Grant, Tony McGinnis, and Paavo Siljamaki, brought to more than 1 million people on a beach in Rio de Janeiro, Brazil. But it's their acoustic recordings that have gotten them into some of the most prestigious venues in the world. They released an unplugged album featuring some of their hits 2 years ago to good success. However, Paavo Siljamaki says the group wanted to do more.
It left us with a real sort of itch to do it again. It felt like we hadn't done enough, or it was nicer than we had initially predicted to play together, and then to have an audience like we had at the Greek really made sense of it all. So that was really why we decided to do acoustic, to really to have a chance to do it again.
During their current tour, the band has sold out the Greek Theater in Berkeley, California, the Sydney, Australia Opera House, and the Hollywood Bowl. Electronic DJs usually cannot play such venues because of volume restrictions. But Tony McGinnis says the acoustic concerts have opened a door the group never thought it would go through.
we sort of Trojan horsed our way into some of these incredibly prestigious venues. I mean, we walked on stage at the Greek Theatre having only done 4 gigs, really. And what band gets to do the Greek Theatre after doing 4 gigs? I can't think of any, you know. We kind of leapfrogged all that kind of years of trailing around the small clubs by bringing our electronic audience to these acoustic venues.
We were in heaven, you and I. And when I lay with you and close my eyes, our fingers touch the sky. I'm sorry.
During its current tour, Above and Beyond is traveling with a 15-piece ensemble. Tony McGinnis sings and plays guitar, mandolin, and ukulele. Paavo Siliamaki plays the piano, vibraphone, and cello. Jono Grant plays the Rhodes piano, guitar, and vibes. When they play the Hollywood Bowl, Above and Beyond will perform with a full 32-piece orchestra. Paavo Siliamaki says the idea of performing at the storied venue still seems unreal.
And I know the electronic and the acoustic are connected. But the fact that, you know, it took us 15 years of touring to be able to, you know, do a show at the Madison Square Garden. And here we are with acoustic. That's actually a really new thing for us. And we can bring it to Hollywood Bowl, which is actually even a bigger venue. So it feels a little unreal, this whole thing. It'll feel real once we're actually on stage doing it, but until then, I don't know.
Above and Beyond's new album, Acoustic 2, goes on sale June 3rd. In Washington, I'm David Byrd.
Yeah, they're very good, I have to tell you. We went to see them a few years ago when they were doing the turntable thing. I can't tell you, they were magnificent doing that. So I can only imagine all acoustic. Pablo and the gang will be superb. If they're in your neighborhood, check them out. I recommend them. Listen, thanks, everyone, for joining us here on the Voice of America for International Edition. Good to have you with us. A reminder, the latest world news is coming up next. Hope you'll stay tuned. For our director, Tracy Carter, and engineer, Jonah Cummings, I'm Steve Norman in Washington. We hope you have a great Friday.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The people of the Lake Chad Basin have much to look forward to, said Deputy Secretary of State Antony Blinken during his recent visit to Nigeria. Their energy, their ingenuity, reflected in young people across the region, points the way towards a future for the Lake Chad Basin defined by growth, by opportunity, by dignity. Nonetheless, they must first rid themselves of a great dangerous storm clouding that bright future. The fight against Boko Haram is a fight for this future, one that unlocks the potential of all people, the prosperity of nations, and peace for the entire region, said Deputy Secretary of State Blinken. Over the last year or so, the Lake Chad Basin countries have made considerable progress in degrading Boko Haram, and we commend all of them, Nigeria, Niger, Chad, Cameroon, and Benin, for standing up the multinational joint task force tasked with ending the Boko Haram insurgency. The United States is deeply committed to supporting this fight and will continue to provide to the task force advisors, training, and necessary resources. But victory on the battlefield is not enough to ensure the lasting defeat of Boko Haram. For that, Boko Haram's ideology must be nullified through government provision of civilian security and civil administration. Human rights abuses must be investigated and abusers held to account. Civilian-military relations must improve. And finally, communities suffering under Boko Haram's heavy fist must be liberated and stabilized. The people provided with humanitarian assistance, basic services, and economic opportunity. If we fail to adopt and pursue this comprehensive approach, we may well defeat Boko Haram on the battlefield, only to be confronted by Boko Haram 2.0 that rises from its ashes, said Deputy Secretary Blinken. As we look ahead to the future, Deputy Secretary Blinken said, the hard challenges of this moment are matched by the promise and potential of this region. We are confident that the Lake Chad Basin countries, with support from the United States, France, the United Kingdom, the European Union, and other international partners, will win this fight and set this region on a course to realize a better future. Let us now turn our unity of vision into sustained unity of action.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. It's 4 hours.